Coming up on tonight's show, Cabinet agrees tax and planning changes to curtail activities of cuckoo funds. A heinous attack. Minister says personal data may be published as government resents paying a ransom. Emergency pandemic powers extended until November, but anger at Cabinet failure to discuss digital green cert as Aer Lingus announces layoffs. All that and more on tonight's Late Debate. But first, the news with Shane McGowan. Thanks, Shane. Good evening and welcome to Tuesday's Late Debate. Joining us tonight, we have Malcolm Byrne, Fianna Fáil Senator and spokesperson for Further and Higher Education, Research, Innovation and Science. Gary Gannon, Social Democrats TD for Dublin Central and spokesperson on Education, Arts, Social Protection and Foreign Affairs. Louise O'Reilly, Sinn Féin TD and spokesperson on Enterprise, Trade and Employment. And Harry McGee, political correspondent with the Irish Times. We want to hear from you, so get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebate_rte. Now, Cabinet, as you were listening, hearing there in the bulletin, Cabinet has agreed to impose a stamp duty charge of 10% on the multiple purchases of 10 or more residential houses. The higher charge will also apply where 10 or more units are acquired on a cumulative basis over any given 12-month period. The Minister for Housing, Dara O'Brien, will also tomorrow issue a circular that will, we're told, fundamentally ban bulk sales for houses and duplexes for all new applications, planning applications, that is, received after the 19th of May. Speaking at a press conference after this evening's Cabinet meeting, Mr. O'Brien said he would be bringing forward an amendment to the Affordable Housing Bill, which would give local authorities the ability to designate a percentage of developments for owner-occupiers and first-time buyers. So there's a lot to get through there. Before we do any of that, actually, Malcolm Byrne, what happened in the Dáil this evening? Sinn Féin's motion proposing the doubling of capital investment to deliver social and affordable housing passed.
Well, my understanding was when the Ceann Comhairle called a vote that what normally happens is when it called thawed that the Sinn Féin motion, somebody said that yes, it was agreed and nobody on the government side disagreed with it. And so the motion was passed. So it was, yeah, it being blunt, I think it was a cock-up.
Louise.
It was. I'm sure it's more than a little bit embarrassing for the
given the
government.
Day that's in it in particular.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the asleep at the wheel, I think I see people on social media saying that, asleep at the wheel, asleep at the wheel this evening, asleep at the wheel for the last 10, 20 years. Really being asleep at the wheel is why we ended up in this situation, allowing the housing crisis to develop to the extent that it has. But I was in the Dáil, actually. It was the Cathaoirleach, the Ceann Comhairle wasn't there, the Cathaoirleach. Obviously put the motion to the floor, and I think there were three ministers there, two senior, one junior minister, and between them they couldn't muster one word. So the motion has been passed.
So the ministers were the members who didn't vote, is it?
Yes. There were three.
Are you going to name names?
Well, I think it's probably a matter of public record who was there, but I will tell you the people that I saw when I looked around, which wasn't the exact moment that the vote was called. But Junior Minister Malcolm Noonan was in the chamber because he had spoken just before me, and I don't think he left. Minister Eamon Ryan had come in, and he was sitting to the right of me, and I think possibly Minister Stephen Donnelly, but definitely the two Green ministers were there.
So they didn't, just to be sure, explain what happened. They didn't vote against the Sinn Féin motion
amendment. The motion was accepted because it was not opposed. What they didn't do, though, and I think the embarrassing thing is they didn't support their own amendment. Now, I wouldn't have supported their own amendment either because, quite frankly, it was awful, but they didn't turn up to support their own amendment, and by dint of that, the Sinn Féin motion has been
passed. Gary, will it make any difference?
No, it won't. Nothing's going to happen. There's been a concern. There's been a strategy from the government over the last couple of months to not oppose motions that are being brought forward from the opposition. So we brought forward a bill a couple of weeks ago in relation to long-term leasing. It wasn't opposed.
But they did have an amendment. Was there not a government amendment?
Yeah, the tactic actually they've been using is not to bring forward amendments at all to kill off debate. But actually they did have an amendment to this one, but they didn't support their own amendment.
Yeah. But it's in the kind of the context of that they've been trying not to have any sort of controversial decisions being taken or used against them. I mean, inevitably we're bringing votes through, and they're voting against what you would have stood for in opposition and then not enacting on them.
But what's really at issue here, and I suppose what listeners are interested in, is Will the government deliver affordable housing? So you can get all the Facebook likes and tweets that you want. But the issue is, what is being brought forward in order to provide for affordable housing?
Yeah.
And that's not going to be done through motions. That's being done through a series of measures. And I actually think what was more important was what Minister O'Brien and Minister Donoghue announced tonight, along with the fact that the important discussions that are going on this week are the Affordable Housing Bill, which started in the Shannon last night, and the Land Development Agency Bill, as well as the other measures, which will actually be what will be of interest to individuals and families.
Let's get to them. Just to explain to people if they weren't tuned into the news this evening, because there's a lot in this. So let's take it from the tax side first. Stamp duty increases to be introduced from tomorrow.
Yeah, essentially once the Oireachtas agrees tomorrow that any purchase of more than 10 properties by any individual, and that includes even if they've set up a number of different companies, once they try to purchase more than 10 properties, not just in an individual estate, but cumulatively across the state, that will be subject then to a 10% stamp duty. And it's not every property after 10, it's if you get to 10, every single one of those properties will be subject to a 10% stamp duty. That's an immediate taxation measure that will hopefully come into effect if obviously the Oireachtas agrees.
And this is restricted to houses and duplexes, not apartments?
It's restricted to houses. Local authorities, approved housing bodies are excluded. But in those circumstances, they would obviously have to have, you know, department approval if they were looking to buy more than 10. The idea is to obviously protect first-time buyers and indeed owner-occupiers, and we can come to tone that. Apartments are excluded, and Minister Pascal Donoghue, you know, made, you know, a very clear explanation as to why that is the case. That if we are to increase supply,
we need
need to increase supply. We need investment funds to build apartments. Nobody else is building the apartments.
I think we actually have a clip of Minister Donoghue explaining why apartments are not included in these new stamp duty measures.
An important exemption from this higher stamp duty charge does refer to the multiple purchase of apartments. So this is a measure that focuses, as is the case with Dara, on the purchase of houses. And we are doing this because of a recognition that apartment developments in particular do face significant viability challenges at times due to their delivery. And there is a role for some forms of purchase there to allow the apartments themselves to be built.
OK, well, we'll come back to that in a moment, because that's obviously going to be a controversial element of this. What about this circular that Minister Dara O'Brien says he's going to will fundamentally ban bulk sales for houses and duplexes for all new planning applications received after tomorrow?
So tomorrow, the chief executive of every local authority will be getting a circular from the minister, which will ban, and as part of the planning process, will ban these bulk sales. That will also be, if you like, made more permanent by an amendment to the Affordable Housing Bill, which is currently going through the Oireachtas. So the approach is to address the issue that has been highlighted, such as in the estate in Maynooth recently. It's a twin-track approach. There are elements which will deal with it on the planning side.
So I'm just slightly confused about that, and you might be able to clarify it for me. If we're banning these sales altogether, a bulk sale, which I presume we're talking about more than 10, is that what we're using as a...
Yeah.
Okay, so if we're banning them altogether, why do we need to bring in tax
disincentives? Well, this is because this is on the planning side, which would allow, you know, for when local authorities are kind of granting the planning permission toward them and allowing the development of particular estates. In the case then of the taxation measures, they will take immediate effect.
So in other words, that would be this is for down the line. And of course, it was, as was acknowledged by Dara O'Brien this evening, there's 80,000 planning permissions across the country which have not been activated.
Can't be affected on the planning side, because obviously, you know, they're subject to the planning laws that were in place up until now. And that's why
that's not an accepted... I mean, I see constitutional and property law experts saying that is not necessarily the case.
Yeah, but that's why on the planning side, that's one measure, and that's on the taxation side when it comes to the purchase, that they, you know, if somebody tries to purchase these, that they will be subject to the 10% stamp duty.
Okay, let me bring in Rory Hearn, Assistant Professor in Social Policy in Maynooth University, author of Housing Shock, which is, of course, a book about the Irish housing crisis. You're very welcome to Late Debate, Rory.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, listening to Malcolm there, and I'm sure you were listening to Pascal Donoghue and Dara O'Brien earlier. Dara O'Brien or Pascal Donoghue saying that this stamp duty increase and this threshold of 10 houses is intended to provide a very significant disincentive to this practice of bulk buying homes by investment funds. Do you believe it will act as a disincentive to those investment funds?
No, I don't. I think that if you look at these funds, they have access to billions of euro in terms of funding. This increase in stamp duty is not significant enough to stop them from bulk buying houses and apartments. I think it's very disappointing, their response. We know the scale of the crisis that's there. We know that these investment funds are have made huge purchases and plan to do that into the future. I think the biggest issue is the two big issues are one, the exemption of apartments from all the measures, both the stamp duty and the planning permission, which means basically investors are going to continue to buy up the majority of apartments, new apartments that are being built. And secondly, the other issue is that, as you said yourself there, that the 80,000 units that are in planning, that have planning permission, will have no restriction on them. I was surprised. I expected some significant measures, like, for example, the abolition of the real estate investment tax break that they set up. I thought that would have been, if they'd removed that, that would have been a significant disincentive. Putting in place other taxes would have been disincentives. And I think that what, to me, looking at it and analysing this, this is not going to stop investor funds. We're going to see in the coming years investor funds continuing to outbid first-time buyers, both in apartments and houses, and we are going to continue to see a significant inflow of the build-to-rent sector, which is locking people into unaffordable rents. And it is important that this isn't just about people being able to buy a home. This is them being able to afford a rental home as well.
In relation to that issue about apartments being completely, I mean, we heard there, we played the clip from Pascal Donoghue, and I saw Michael O'Flynn, the builder, on Primetime just before we came down to studio, basically saying the same thing, that he's building in Cabinteely at the moment. It's a mixed development of apartments and houses. And he said those apartments in that development would not have been built without the funding that came from these investment funds, and that if that funding goes elsewhere, we will not see any apartments being built.
We see that's just plainly not true, because we know that there is a difference between investment that wants to come in and, you know, support and fund the building of apartments, houses, and they can do that at a reasonable cost, that is produced relatively nothing like what is being done. But there's also investment funds that are coming in here and that are developing within Ireland itself that want to build units that are extremely expensive, that are at a very high rent, and to rent those into the future at very high rents. So there's a different types of investment. And the issue is that we have the funding to build affordable housing in this country. We have the state can borrow itself at essentially zero cost. We have access to the European Investment Bank. And I think that there is this sort of false dichotomy being put up there, that if we don't have this finance coming in on the build-to-rent basis, we're not going to have a supply of housing. But it's a flawed argument. We've had this increased supply from this type of build-to-rent, vulture fund, cuckoo funds over the last few years, and rents have continued to increase. The supply of that type of housing doesn't reduce rents or prices. What would do that is if the government built affordable housing on scale. And I think the biggest scandal is we have NAMA sitting there selling units to investor funds, and it has the ability itself to build tens of thousands of units. It's a state agency sitting there, but it won't build them. Because I think in actual fact, and I've said this, the government doesn't really want to build affordable housing on scale that would disrupt the market.
I'm going to have to disagree with a lot of what Rory said. And I think this is the ideological difference that's here. And Rory's entitled to his view, but very clearly he doesn't see a role for the private investor. And you talked about Michael O'Flynn. And if you talk to, you know, any of the builders around the country, and they'll tell you that they're not getting the loans coming from the pillar banks. They need these international investors to come in to help to provide the properties.
What Rory was saying is that the government should be sourcing funding from
because it's cheap money, but not at the scale that would actually have an impact on the housing supply that we need. Investment in public housing ever this year in terms of 3.3 billion. We're going to need over the period to be able to deliver the 33,000 houses that we need, social, affordable and private, over the next decade, we're going to need something of the order of about 90 billion. The ideological difference between myself and the others here on the programme tonight is that I see a role for the private investor, because if we don't have some of those international investment funds, if we don't have the private builder in there building those properties, it won't happen. The problem on the, and I do need to take
Should we be encouraging it to continue to happen if they're building apartments that are totally unaffordable for anyone, even high salaries?
Yeah, the biggest problem. So what is the government doing on that? So the biggest problem at the moment in the market is around supply, which everybody accepts. And part of the problem is that we are seeing a lot of small landlords getting out of the market. And there is this idea about this giant landlord class out there. 70% of landlords, a lot of them are accidental landlords, only own one property. What's happening in the case of a lot of the apartment buildings, and yes, it is...
But isn't the difficulty there is that they have a completely different tax treatment to these REITs and investment funds, and no wonder that they can't compete in that market.
So if it was foreign direct investment
that we were looking at, taxing those small landlords in a different way, and more viable way, maybe. But here's what we are looking at, right?
So there are a number of new models that are coming in, including the cost rental model, which is being introduced as part of the affordable housing legislation. Because what we need to do is we need to do a number of things. We need to increase supply, and we're only going to be able to do that by getting builders, the construction sector, private industry back up and running. And what we've got to do is, it's not about looking at any individual aspect of this, it's about looking at it in the whole. And one of the things...
Okay, Malcolm, I'm going to have to let other people in here because you've been very patient. I'm going to just ask Harry first before I go to you, and then I will go to you guys. Harry, the response to this, the big plan, the big reveal in the Dáil this evening wasn't terribly positive.
No. What did you expect? We'd get a kind of a Eurovision type vote out of it, Katie? I don't think so. I think that each of the parties resorted, as they're entitled to, their own position in terms of housing. And of course, as we've heard, the opposition parties fundamentally disagree with the direction of government policy in this regard. And there was also disagreement within government, we understand, particularly in relation to the exemption that was afforded to apartment buildings. All three Green ministers, we understood, argued vehemently against that exemption, but they were outvoted by their colleagues at the end of the day. Basically, the argument that Pascal Donoghue, we heard on the clip, was the one that prevailed in terms of government thinking. But, you know, we've seen in Britain the impact of the vaccine bounce for Boris Johnson's government. He was the villain of the piece last year, and suddenly they have a vaccination programme that makes him a hero. If the government, which is doing really well on the vaccination programme at this moment in time, is expecting a bounce, it's not going to happen. Once the cloud of COVID begins to lift, housing is going to hove in as the big issue of the day. And the government, particularly Fianna Fáil, are all in on housing. If they don't deliver the 50,000 social homes, if they don't deliver the 33,000 new homes per annum between now and the end of the government's term, they are going to be absolutely end up with a very, very tough election, as will Fine Gael. If we look at the 2020 election, I mean, Fine Gael emerged out of the election with a significant loss of seats. And when you look at the reason that that occurred, it was because of housing. So once COVID goes, I think housing is going to hove into view as the main issue, and the government will need to deliver on it unless it's going to be trouble electorally for both parties.
Absolutely.
And the Greens.
Yeah, Louise O'Reilly.
Well, I think the measures announced this evening show that they're not really serious about tackling this issue at all. There are effectively generations of people being locked out of secure homes. And I spoke in the Dáil this evening and I talked about my own experience. And by the time my daughter was 5 years of age, she had had six different addresses, because that's what it's like when you rent in Dublin. And that, I mean, this is well over 20 years ago now. So I bought a house. I didn't buy an investment. I bought a house, a home, a place to raise my family, somewhere where I knew I could be secure for myself, my husband and our daughter. It wasn't an investment, but I look now at my daughter. She works damn hard. She has a good job. She and her young son have had to move out of the city because they simply can't afford to live in Dublin. And she would love to have the security of not having to rent, particularly under this government and their attitude to renters. But she doesn't. And so therefore, she wants to be able to buy her own home. And at every turn, it seems like it gets further and further away. And she is one person, and they are one family. But this is an absolute crisis. And the response from the government this evening shows that they don't take it seriously. Well, they should have ensured that they applied capital gains tax. The 10% surcharge isn't going to work. And they've also should have ensured...
But you see, I was asking Eoin O'Brien last Saturday, in studio last Saturday, what should they do about stamp duty? What level should it be raised to if that's going to be used as part of the levers here? And Eoin O'Brien couldn't tell me what Sinn Féin believes.
Because we had a package of measures that didn't just include one measure, but the government have opted for one measure and it's 10%. It's 15%.
Well, they've opted as well for this planning. They have opted for planning issues.
Okay, so in terms of taxation, they've opted for one. They have decided to let them completely skate on the capital gains tax, as you know, what was predicted by a lot of people, not just Eoin O'Brien and others. I mean, the fear was that the response would be knee-jerk but lack ambition, and that's exactly what it was.
Okay,
I think it's really interesting that Malcolm used the phrase the ideology of those who are sitting beside him, as in having a different ideology. I think it's always important to counter that by saying, actually, we've never had a chance to enact their ideology when it comes to housing. And the housing crisis, as it currently stands, is a response to a particular ideology of a laissez-faire, hands-off, the market dictates all policy, which has been enabled by Fianna Fáil and ran by Fine Gael. But I'll continue on the measures that were announced tonight. A stamp duty charge of 10% isn't actually going to consequence in really much of a difference when you consider that these investment funds have been outbidden, and I think it was nearly close to 80,000 over what housing organisations are coming in. So 10% stamp duty is not really going to consequence in much. And then I represent an urban constituency, which essentially people who grew up there or even want to live there have coming in. I've been told actually it's going to be unaffordable. I can't understand the policy where clearly rents that have been able to be investment funds are able to charge as much as you like in terms of rents, and this is going to do nothing to stop that fact.
Yeah, is it like we're basically abandoning the city?
We're
basically saying, you know what, off you go. You do what you want in there, because we can't figure out a way to build apartments for anything affordable.
It's not,
so off you go.
It's ironic that Louise says the government is lacking ambition, and you know Gary saying the state isn't intervening. If we look at the piece of legislation,
you're not intervening.
On the affordable homes measure, right, in terms of the affordable housing, the first ever affordable housing piece of legislation introduced in the state, which came before the Seanad, the Land Development Agency bill, which is coming in, two very ambitious pieces of legislation, which will empower local authorities to build on state land. When we talk about, and Louise mentions about her daughter, if you look at the affordable houses that are being made available in North Dublin, where we're talking about, and what we're imagining the cost would be, it will be between 160 and 250,000, which is affordable.
How many of those houses were built?
Within the reach of, I don't know, Louise might know the exact
61.
Numbers.
61 houses.
Yeah. And I accept that is a start.
Okay. How many people do you think are ahead of my daughter to apply for that?
Here's part of the challenge.
No, but I'm asking you a question. How many people do you think are going to for every affordable house?
And you know,
so when we say it lacks ambition,
issue.
When we say it lacks ambition, we mean it lacks the ambition to actually sort it.
Here's the ambition.
And when we say that you're locking renters and people out of affordable homes in the city centre, you are surrendering the city centre to these real estate investment trusts. You are putting homes further and further away from
but this
families.
Is this is the rhetoric.
That's
we need
happening.
No.
That
we,
is a
we
fact.
Need to we need
that
to
is a fact.
Here's the question what people need to know. We need to build 33,000 homes a year. Local authorities are going to be able to provide it through the various guises under these supports 15,000. We then need the private sector to provide about 18,000 a year. In terms of for renters, and if we look at for the first time when we talk about the introduction of the long cost rental model, when we talk about the Berlin and Vienna model, and how's that going to work? And a practical example in terms of the Enniskerry Road in Dunleary, where at the moment, if somebody looks to rent a two bed out there, it's costing over €2,000. Under the cost rental model here, which will guarantee renters tenure for a long period, it will cost them about €1,200. This is about being ambitious. And it's not about,
Katie,
you know, just one or two little issues. And I totally disagree with Gary, because part of the problem has been, and this is where Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael will differ. Fine Gael do believe in market-led solutions. In a Fianna Fáil approach, what we believe is, because we've always been the party to support the aspiration to own home ownership, when the state needs to step in, it will.
So
but
Fianna Fáil does not believe the market is going to
start.
No, it doesn't. But at the same time, we support the aspiration. We support the aspiration towards home ownership. And we also recognise that in order to
But it was under Fianna Fáil that the local authorities and government generally pulled back and allowed the market to deliver social.
Can I tell you that the highest numbers, we were still delivering up until 2008, 2009, we were still delivering up to 8,000 local authority homes every year. What is now happening is we're going to be empowering local authorities to be able to deliver social and affordable housing on state land. And what's more than about just empowering
Rory's to deliver. Sorry to cut across you, Malcolm. Rory.
Yeah, I think it's very important to take a step back for this. And I think it's very disappointing the government is throwing around this ideology accusation as if they don't have an ideology themselves. And, you know, my ideology, I'm very clear about it. It's about the right to housing, and it is about the housing system. The function of the housing system is to deliver affordable, secure homes for people. Whereas I think the ideology of Malcolm, and he set it out there, he said that the ideology of Fine Gael is market delivered. I think Fianna Fáil's not too far behind them. And if you look at the money, you look at where is the investment from the state. If we look at how many affordable housing, they're talking about the Land Development Agency, the Affordable Housing Bill, local authorities being empowered, the cost rental, but actually go to the figures. We're talking about potentially 4,000 affordable homes over 4 years. We're talking about cost rental units. They've only 400 planned. Like, these are drops in the ocean for what is actually needed.
But Rory, 3,000 homes a year, Rory.
Yeah, can I ask, Rory, I mean, it seems to me that this argument has come down over the last couple of weeks when there's been such a focus on it, is do we need this money? These funds in the marketplace, do we need them to forward fund development and apartment building in particular? Or is there a way or means for government to raise that money and that funding from whatever sources itself?
Yeah.
And that seems to be, we're being told, I'm sorry, we can't do that. We don't have access to that level of fund.
Yeah, and I think that's wrong. We, as I said, it's very clearly the state can borrow to build. We have billions in the credit unions. NAM is sitting there, as I said, with funding, with the ability to build tens of thousands of units. This idea that we're reliant on state, on these investment funds to build our housing is exactly the problem, that we've relied on the market. We've become over-reliant on the market. And these investment funds, you know, if they want to come in and build, you know, let them come in and build, but don't let them buy up all the rental units. Don't let them buy up all these apartments. This is going to have, you know, impacts on generation rent, who will be stuck renting. What happens when they reach retirement age? What happens when they can't afford the rents? This, like, I think the leaving out of apartments is showing that they're not serious about actually
living in an apartment in Dublin city centre, say, or even out in Malahide or anywhere around it, or Swords, or anywhere around Dublin County. and you were paying 2,000 plus euros a month in rent, I don't know how in the name of God you would be able to afford to save for a deposit if you were on an ordinary income. The simple fact is you couldn't. And what the government policy has done, Katie, and this is important, is it has facilitated the commodification of what should be a very basic human right. It's the right to shelter.
Yeah. And can I just put this to you, and I'm very conscious that you are fighting fires on all sides here. So I do think this is a very fundamental point for all those people out there, as Louise just mentioned, people who are paying perhaps 2,000 a month, very, very, very high rents, you know, struggling more than maybe 50% of their salary on rent. This is not allowing those funds to continue to build more apartments in this line. That's not going to bring down the price of their rent. Well, like, that is fundamentally not going to. Do we have to now say this is where it's at? You know, we might hold on to this level, but actually you're never again going to go back to being able to get away with a third of your income.
These are friends of mine. These are people whom I know. And I mean, I don't doubt anyone, you know, here wants to ensure that we get, you know, a roof over everybody's head. What we differ on is the way that we're going to get there. So, you know, this is something we all want to achieve. The biggest challenge around ensuring that there are enough roofs over people's heads is supply. And we've got to ensure that we get an adequate supply of all forms of housing, affordable houses for people to rent, because some people prefer to rent. I differ in probably from others in that I also believe that we should encourage people to be able to aspire to own their own home. That's something I think most people do.
I don't think you differ from anyone in this room on that.
If I'm allowed to answer, Louise,
it's not a fact. It's not true.
But here's the biggest challenge on the apartment side. If we are going to increase, so one of the criticisms is that we don't have enough good landlords. So we've got to increase the supply and the quality of rental accommodation in Ireland. That is what is happening. We're seeing an exodus of small landlords out of the system at the moment. That's why essentially that there is that supply problem. If we increase the supply issue,
is there? There isn't any real hope or aspiration in any of this that the rents we're seeing right now are going to come down, because we know we had masses of supply before the crash and house prices did not affect house prices.
If we increase supply, what that will mean is down the line that we will see the cost of rental being reduced, because part of the problem is the supply is not there. And Minister Donoghue made clear that when he answered a number of questions on it this evening. And then the second, which is the point that I made around the cost rental model, which is about giving security of tenure, which is, as happens in Berlin and Vienna, which is the model we want to see and why the government is ambitious, is that people who want to rent for a long period of time.
Can I come in here?
Rory, just in relation to that cost rental model, this is something we've been hearing about for years, and I think
I think the cost rental model is absolutely essential. You know, the building of affordable, the idea of cost rental, and if we look at countries like Austria and Vienna where they have it, what it does is it's basically rental housing that's provided by either local authorities or not-for-profit housing associations or cooperatives. It's lifetime tenancies. And it is genuinely actually affordable. And we need that model here as well. And the key thing is it's available basically for anybody on any income, on middle income. So it's fundamentally different from our social housing, which is limited to those on low incomes. The problem with our cost rental as we're developing it here is, number one, it is nowhere on the scale of what is actually required. You should be building about 4,000 to 5,000 cost rental units per year. If you were serious about really addressing the rental crisis and providing people that option of affordable rental housing. That is the first thing, and I don't see any evidence of that whatsoever.
Okay.
And I think it comes back to the government's reluctance to disturb or disrupt the market. I really think they're terrified and they don't want to. They think they're interested.
Can I come in here?
Supplying affordable housing.
Investors.
Really important. No, hang on a minute. The investor funds made it very clear that they said the biggest threat to their profitability was the development of affordable housing by the government. And if it can't be any clearer well, then, you know, if you actually want to disrupt these investors, if we want affordable housing, the government ensures its provision.
They don't
it's as simple as straightforward as
that. Okay, okay, everyone, I'm trying to get it. Gary?
I've seen nothing in the announcement today that's going to give hope to any renter in the constituency in Dublin City Central that I represent, that the exorbitant rents will be brought down. I don't see why we can't tackle high rents by legislating for it if necessary. But then there's also a point about the Minister's interpretation of cost rental under the housing. So the actual cost rental, as we know in Vienna, is linked to the cost price of development plus maintenance costs. The Minister's interpretation is cost rental is linked to the market rent plus a discount. So even amongst the cost rental as we have here, there's also a market element of it. That's not cost rental. That's a Fianna Fáil version of cost rental.
Okay, just give you a sense of what people are saying about our debate tonight. Why are they discounting apartments as homes? People across Europe live in apartments for their whole lives. Why are we different? Irish people by nature do not like renting, says another texter. The property market is manipulated to keep supply low and prices high. Back in the early 70s, we were great people to buy houses on bad wages. There is no difference now to back then. Houses have always been expensive. And every village and town in Ireland has derelict houses. They have vacant spaces over shops, council houses left vacant. Renovate those houses and put those houses back into the rental market and make grants available for this purpose, which I think a lot of people have been arguing for. Sorry, Harry, you were trying to get in there.
Yeah, the impression has been given that every apartment in the country has been built by these cuckoo funds or vulture funds, and that's not true. And just to give it a bit of context, you know, the amount of residential units under institutional ownership is about 1% of the total housing stock, or about 15,500 at the end of 2020. And I think it's about 5% of all rental tenancies. So, I mean, just lest people think that every apartment and every development has been built by a cuckoo fund, an investor fund, you know, because everybody's had their
spake here.
I just wanted to put a bit of context into that. And just in relation to the cost rental and affordable homes, I think the opposition focused in on the affordable housing bill, on the shared equity thing, which was the most problematic part of it for the government. But there was also the affordable homes, which will be done in conjunction with the LDA. And they are developing sites in places like Shangana, at the Colbert station in Limerick, in Dundrum and elsewhere. I think Rory was saying that the number of units would be quite small, and it is, and they need to get more land. And also the cost rental model. Their difficulty is one of scale. And to get the kind of the momentum of scale behind them is going to take many years. So by the time a lot of these policies come to fruition, you know, it won't even be the next government that will be in power. It will be the government after that that will be in power. Even if you look at the controversy last week in relation to Glanbia and the appeal that is going to the Supreme Court, planning permission was granted for that plant in 2019. And there is a difficulty in terms with move in Irish politics in general, but particularly in relation to planning, the gap in time between a decision and implementation of that decision can sometimes take years and often can take decades. And this is the intractable problem that the government has in relation to housing. It wants to do 50,000 units between now and the end of its term. I just can't see how it can possibly do that.
But they could significantly curtail the activities of these
The point I was making is that that's just one component of a very, very complicated picture. And I take your point on that completely. There are many other components in relation to this challenge.
To add one point to Harry's around the whole question of urban regeneration. Like, there are lots of different things that are happening here. We haven't even touched it on Irish Water or dealing with Bord Pleanála, and Harry is right around that. There's 1.3 billion which is being spent as part of the Urban Regeneration and Development Fund, which will benefit primarily the cities and also large urban centres. Like in Wexford Town, I know there's an 18.5 million project. People in Waterford will know about the North Keys project. So those are significant projects to regenerate those urban areas, including, by the way, in terms of building suitable housing that's in there. So this is not about, one or two simple measures. There are a whole suite of measures. By the way, there were four pieces of rental legislation that Dara O'Brien has introduced
I had a joke before I came down and said, who will be the first person to say suite of measures tonight? You won, Malcolm.
Rory, that's what we have. Rory, have a comprehensive suite. It's not just about one thing. It's an ambitious programme.
Okay, Rory, I'll just give you the last word. We need to move on from this. But just finally, in response to what Malcolm Byrne was saying there. They have a suite of measures.
I think that the, as I said, that the measures that they've announced now will be ineffective. And I think that's the purpose of them. They're not going to deter investment funds on any serious level. The exemption of apartments means they will continue to buy up apartments. They will continue to buy up houses. And I think that a radical change in housing policy is required. And Malcolm knows that, but it's not happening. And if you look at, for example, development, and I think that issue is that Generation Rent, and I think are going to continue the anger, the upset, the destruction of this housing crisis. What it's doing to people is absolutely horrendous and disgraceful.
And we that's need why immediate, we're out to build homes, pressure, immediate... Rory. That's why we're out to build homes.
Okay, we're going to have to leave that there. Rory Hearn, thank you for joining us this evening. We'll let you go and we'll come back and talk about the cyber attack after these.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. Now, the Minister of State for Public Procurement and E-Government, Oisin Smith, has said he expects that some data involved in the HSE cyber attack will be published in the future, as the government is not going to pay a ransom. This is an extraordinary story, and it's, I think we're only really in the foothills of where this may take us. Gary, that's a very stark assessment, but I think most people looking at this now and hearing what we've heard over the last few days would say, yeah, it's almost inevitable.
Look, we're in the midst of a national crisis here, and we're under attack, and the repercussions of this attack are still not yet fully established or known. On Thursday, when this first emerged that we were under a cyber attack, it was kind of downplayed. It was almost as if we couldn't access emails, we're locked out of our computers, but we'll get through it. We didn't give this the seriousness it deserved over the last couple of days, and nor over the last number of years. If you think about the investment in our cyber security threats, look, our national safety assessment since 2014 has highlighted a cyber threat as a very likely attack that would emerge. We've seen, I think Minister Donnelly and Minister Ryan tonight in the Dáil acknowledge that actually health systems over the world are being targeted. And yet we had no contingency plan, no continuity of business plan, no almost like a cobra like equivalent of what would kick in the event of a strike of this nature hitting us. And it's just, I'm flabbergasted to see the extent of it.
But is there a degree to which there's, you know, when you've got these criminals operating at the level that they are operating, and they obviously have decided, given we're in a pandemic, that health systems across the world are vulnerable at this time, that it's almost impossible to stop this happening. Is that?
Well, it's almost impossible when you've invested the small amount of funds that we have in our National Cyber Security Agency over the last 6-7 years. Last year was brought up to 5 million, still not even close to being enough. We don't have a head of our National Cyber Security Agency at the minute. And we also don't really know who's in charge. Our Minister of Communications was notable by his absence over the last couple of days. Stephen Donnelly didn't really emerge until today. This is an attack on us where Minister for Defence has said absolutely zilch.
He's been talking to the Russians. Minister for Foreign Affairs Simon Coveney has spoken to his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov about the cyber attack. The exchange happened yesterday during a scheduled call regarding UN Security Council business. The Russian embassy here said it was willing to look into the matter.
I think
is that very reassuring?
No, I'm not the slightest bit reassured, to be honest. And I tell you, if I was a health service worker expecting my wages on Thursday, I'd be even less so. Because thus far, the only commitment that can be given to those workers, and I mean, I don't think they'll stand for another round of applause in lieu of wages, is that they will get their, most likely get their basic pay, but they won't get their premiums. And I mean, anyone who knows anything about the health service knows it's 24/7 operation.
Is that the current state of play there, that wages will be paid?
That basic pay will be paid, but for an awful lot of workers, I mean, their basic wages would be very, very small, so they would need their premiums. Indeed, they have worked. They don't get paid in advance for overtime. They will have worked that overtime, work that Saturday, work that overnight. So I do think, you know, a special effort needs to be made to ensure that at the very least, because God knows our healthcare workers have to work in chronic conditions, that at the very least they get paid for the work that they're doing. But I think, you know, over over a long number of years, you know, there has been a lack of investment within the IT infrastructure in the HSE. It was something, I was a member of the Future of Healthcare's Longer Care Committee, and it was something something that we looked at. And at the time, we think that's gone back 5 years. Like at the time, the health service was in dire need, not just of a plan, because of course we know they're coming down with plans, but a fully resourced plan. But we know from your colleague on Morning Ireland that as recently as December 2020, there were upwards of 37,000 HSE computers operating off of Windows 7. So, I mean, it's arguable that yes, this attack these are international criminals, absolutely. But we left ourselves not in the best position to be able to fight that. That's a fact. And nobody on the government side, as they have emerged, as has been pointed out, they've emerged a bit belated into this debate. There's nobody saying that we went into this in good condition, because absolutely we didn't. They didn't. And I think it wasn't inevitable that we would be attacked. But I think the response now is going to be to spend tens of millions of euros, because that will have to be spent to ensure the systems are robust. But there will have to be questions asked as to why successive ministers for health ignored the very real need to modernise the IT infrastructure within the HSE. And yeah, that lessons need to be learned from that. I fear that they won't be, Katie, but lessons will have to be learned.
Drop the ball, Malcolm?
This is much broader. It's a national security issue. I've been one of those who've been raising about the importance of data, that we need to start to treat data like gold. From an Irish perspective, the fact that about 30% of the EU's data is stored in Ireland is something that should be of concern to us. We do now have, and the others are right, we do now have a National Cybersecurity Centre. The Gardaí are now rolling out a series of cybercrime units around the country. But this is not just about, you know, in individual services, and the IT systems need to be upgraded. Why I said that this is a national security issue is this is where the wars of the future are going to be taking place. It's all going to be in cyberspace. If you look at the attacks that have happened, if you looked at what happened at Colonial on the East Coast in the US, we see the New Zealand system that's there. And in some of these cases, it's not just, I mean, people have this image of hackers as, you know, some guy with a ponytail on a keyboard in a basement. This is not. These are sophisticated operations. In some cases, they are backed by state actors. It requires global cooperation. But, and by the way, if you remember, Casey, the big row about PESCO, one of the reasons we wanted to join PESCO was around cyber cooperation to be able to deal with this. Interestingly, Sinn Féin and the Social Democrats opposed and continue to oppose that level of cooperation. And I think now that they're seeing the threat of cyber defence, I would hope Sinn Féin and the Social Democrats would reconsider the importance in terms of national security, the need to cooperate with other countries through PESCO. But that's why we joined PESCO.
That's a ridiculous comment.
So nobody for a moment imagines, I absolutely love the way people do this, nobody for a minute imagines that the hacker is the character from The Simpsons as described, some lad with a ponytail sitting in a basement. Everybody understands that this is a sophisticated international criminal gang. Nice try to blame the opposition for this, but that's simply not the case. Please let me finish.
That's simply not the case. Do you favour joining PESCO to deal with this?
This is an international security incident, absolutely. But what I am saying is we left ourselves vulnerable. It is not, it won't come as a surprise to anyone who watches what goes on within the HSE.
Will you respond to the PESCO, issue?
Okay, so the PESCO issue is one that we had debated in the Dáil, and it's not simply the case of cooperating in relation to one specific issue. But as you've said, the Minister for Foreign Affairs has reached out. He is talking to his counterparts. That has to be done. We have all sorts of levels of international cooperation that go on, and that has to be done. But we also need to look to our own defences, and we need to look at ways that we can ensure that that will not happen again. So yes, we left ourselves vulnerable. Yes, it is going to cost tens of millions of euros, but the outcome of it has to be that we will have a robust system in place to protect that data,
I want to let Harry in.
This is going to cost hundreds of millions, tens of millions.
Hundreds of millions.
Mm-hmm. Because this is data. I mean, if you think about it,
literally just sorting out this.
The immediate challenge, but I think the knock-on impact.
Immediate challenge would be tens of millions.
The immediate impact, because what it has done is, I mean, there was a plan within the HSE, but obviously all of the HSE staff who've now had to be diverted to doing other things. I mean, I never thought it'd be so callous that somebody could hit a health service, but these guys will go and do it in the middle of a pandemic. But let's be very clear about this. We are going to face other cyber attacks on other aspects.
So we're going to have to spend hundreds of millions to protect ourselves from future attacks.
I've engaged with Irish Water, with, you know, people in Airgrid and others around making sure that those systems are in place, because it could equally be a case of, you know, next week a local authority could be attacked and people might think, well what impact there? Could you imagine if the traffic management system was hacked into by somebody from the outside and the impact that that would have? We're only lucky, and it still may be the potential that lives could be lost as a result of this attack on the HSE. And until we start to treat data like gold, mm-hmm. until we treat it as a national security issue, we are going to continue to have these problems.
Okay. Harry McGee.
Yeah, I mean, I think even if the HSE had updated its Windows from Windows 7 to XP or to more modern ones, I think it still would have been vulnerable to attack. If you look at the number of cyber attacks worldwide, even this year, the Centre for Strategic Study has identified 40 major attacks already this year in 2021. It seems to be one of the symptoms of COVID. As Malcolm Byrne was saying, there was one in Waikato. If you go back to 2017, 2018, the NHS in Britain was attacked by cyber attackers called WannaCry, and they caused an estimated £100 million pounds worth of damage. And the circumstances behind that attack look eerily similar to the attack on the HSE. And of course, like in the development of any health service, there's always a balance between the administrative side and the frontline side. And it's a very, very hard balance to strike. I heard Tony O'Brien saying that the percentage of funds that was invested in IT in the Irish health system was low, and perhaps it should have been higher.
But I just think
any health system, I mean, the most sophisticated systems in the world are open to even more sophisticated cyber attacks.
It's to do with the recovery time, Harry. It's not just simply that all IT systems can be vulnerable, but the recovery time is made longer by a lack of IT.
Sure, it is. But there's no way. The point I'm making, Louise, is
hundreds of thousands of people now who are going to miss their care, who will be added to the list that will tip up to 900,000 by the end of this week.
But could we have inured ourselves from an attack like this by updating the system?
Well, just
Trinity, we've one voice.
I think it's, we all accept that an attack was inevitable. Successful attacks are not necessarily inevitable. And just to say, the system that they're using in the HSE at the moment is the computerized infectious disease report, otherwise known as CDER. It's a legacy type of system, meaning it's outdated. It was brought in 2004. Now, if you imagine what your mobile phone looked like in 2004, that's the data security system they're using in the HSE at the minute. It's a legacy system that's outdated. So while a sophisticated attack was expected, the fact that we didn't have the infrastructure to protect ourselves was not.
But can I just want to ask you, Harry, I mean, the politics of this could get quite difficult for the government over the coming weeks if the HSC struggles to get some of those systems back online, if care is being, appointments are being postponed, cancer care is being delayed. You know, this could get very, very politically
of course it could.
Tricky,
I mean,
couldn't it?
And I'm not saying that no blame should be attributed to government. Of course it should, and they should have updated and invested more in IT systems. But the point I was making was that all systems, no matter how sophisticated, will always be vulnerable to attacks like that. And if you even the most sophisticated military systems in the world have been vulnerable to attack. And the point that Louise was making was a fair point, is that the recovery will be a bit slower. I think the government will be vulnerable if it doesn't recover things quickly.
But as we saw Britain three years ago, that's going to cost a lot of money
and it's going to take a lot of time, and they are going to ship damage about it. There's no doubt about that.
Okay, I'm going to have to take my last break.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And that is all we have time for tonight. I want to thank my panel. I want to thank you all for listening. The programme was produced by Caroline Dalton. Research was by Andrew Fleming. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon. And Tom Norton was on sound. And now I'll hand you over to Cathal Murray on Late Debate.